Well, it may be like the sermonette. You'll see that in a moment. Well, we are headed into the days of unleavened bread. Passover season is upon us, just about 3 or 4 weeks away now. So I'm going to try to do something a bit different. As we were heading into the Passover season, I knew I would have to be giving sermons about the Passover and the days of unleavened bread. And I thought, how can I approach this in a little bit different way as to make it interesting, just something that we haven't done before. So hopefully we've come up with something. Of course, we often cover various aspects of these days, the meaning of these days. We talk about repentance, our calling from God. We talk about overcoming, talk about putting sin out of our lives, certainly with the analogy of leavening. We put sin out of our lives and we eat the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. We replace it with righteousness. So we've already talked about some of those things in the sermons already that you've heard from not only from me but from our elders as well. During these sermons, we cover the meaning of the bread and wine, very significant, of course. At other times, though, as we prepare for and give sermons about the Passover and about the days of unleavened bread, we look back to the events of the Israelites coming out of Egypt. Again, very appropriate that the sermonette gave us a very good look at what that was like, and it asked us to put ourselves in their place. That's what we're going to try to do in the sermon today. In fact, not only in this sermon, but in a series of sermons. We're going to look back at the events of the Israelites coming out of Egypt and how they became types of what we are to do, spiritually speaking, today. Hopefully we'll do that in a rather intense and a meaningful way. Instead of just going to the Old Testament and reading some of the scriptures, we're going to do exactly as it was referenced in the sermonette that we do. We're going to try to recreate from scripture exactly what it was like to live through those days. If you were the typical Israelite family, what was it like? My hope is that we make this story come alive for all of us, especially I'm thinking of our young people as well, but also so that it can give us a much more full and complete appreciation of the spiritual application of what these days mean, what these events mean for our lives today. So to fully capture the entire story with all of the significant events contained in the story, the sermon's going to be given in three parts. Today will be part one. We're going to begin with the period of time before Moses was born. We'll eventually end the series of sermons with the spies' evil report and the sentence of 38 and a half more years of wandering in the wilderness. If you'll turn with me to Exodus 1, we'll set the stage for our story. Exodus 1 and verse 1. We have the listing of the children of Israel who came to Egypt. Each man and his household came with Jacob. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, Benjamin, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, Asher. All of these were the descendants of Jacob. There were 70 persons. Joseph was in Egypt already. Of course, we know the background story. So at this time, we're at the year 1682 BCE. Jacob, now known as Israel, is very happy to have been reunited with his lost son, Joseph. Israel was 130 years old. Joseph was 39. That's our best estimate for their age and the dates that I'm going to be presenting. Israel now lives in Egypt. Again, the man Israel lives in Egypt with his sons and all their families for another 17 years. And dies in 1665 BCE. Time goes on for another 54 years. All is well, or so they thought. Families are prospering. It seems like a normal life. But finally, verse 6, Joseph died. the year 1611 BCE. And all his brothers and all that generation. That's an important point. They've all died. But the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly, multiplied and grew exceedingly mighty, and the land was filled with them. So, as I would calculate, approximately 30 more years would pass after this as the Israelites grew and prospered. Pharaohs came and went until finally, one day, verse 8. Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. So a generation's passed at least. I don't know who Joseph is. And he said to his people, "Look, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply. And it happened in the event of war that they would join our enemies and fight against us, and so go up out of the land." And they didn't want them to leave. So with this background in mind, let's go there. Let's now be introduced to Joe Israelite. He and his new wife Mary are a young couple in their early 20s. They've had a wonderful childhood, living in the wealth and splendor of Egypt, surrounded by countless friends and family members with whom they have so much in common. The year is now 1581 BCE. It's been 101 years since Israel, or Jacob, came to Egypt. And it's been 30 years since Joseph died. All they've ever known was basically a tranquil life of farming, tending to the many herds of livestock, the sheep, the cattle, constructing fine homes to live in a fertile Nile Delta, a land known as Goshen. Things are about to change. Early one morning, as Joe Israelite was preparing to head out into the fields, he was startled as he looked to see what appeared to be dozens of Egyptian soldiers approaching their village. What could they be doing? Was Egypt being attacked by some outside army? Were they coming to ask us to fight with them? The soldiers began shouting orders to everyone as they began to overrun the village. "Everyone line up," the soldiers shouted. "Pharaoh has an important announcement for all of you Israelites." "I wonder what this could be about," Joe and Mary Israelite wondered. After everyone was quiet, a spokesman for the soldiers began to speak. "You Israelites have been our guests in Egypt for many years now. It has become your home too. Now there are so many of you. The Pharaoh has decided we need to build even larger cities to help house you and to provide larger storage buildings for all of our own supplies, plus the supplies that we are providing to other nations around us. But we Egyptians, we cannot do all the work. And so Pharaoh has decided to hire many of you Israelites to work on these new building projects. He's agreed to pay good wages to anyone who will accept this offer. Plus, he will provide access to additional food supplies. If you will work on this new special building project," again, we'll provide, I read that wrong, "we'll provide you with the additional food supplies if you'll agree to work on this special building project." Joe Israelite could hardly believe the good news. "Mary," he said, "this sounds like the perfect job for me. I'm so tired of just farming and tending the cattle. I'd much rather learn how to construct new buildings, perhaps even have a chance to see other parts of the country. And besides, we could use the extra money and extra food since you're expecting our first child. I'm going to volunteer." Mary eagerly agreed that this would be an excellent opportunity. And many of Joe's neighbors also agreed, and they stepped forward to inform the soldier, yes, they're ready to accept Pharaoh's generous offer of a new job. Even with so many volunteering, there were still many left behind to help with the farms. The soldier said many Egyptian men and women would help work the farms as well. Everything was going to be just fine. But it was not going to be just fine. What Joe Israelite and the others did not know was that this was a cleverly devised trap by Pharaoh along with his advisors. Pharaoh was going to control the population of the Israelites, and he would now control them in a very unexpected way. Exodus 1, verse 11. Therefore they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with their burdens. But the first few weeks on the new job just didn't seem so bad. In fact, Joe Israelite kind of enjoyed the change of pace. He was quickly learning a new skill. His overseers were a bit impatient, he thought, but they carefully and meticulously showed Joe just exactly how to find the right type of rocks, how to chisel them into large squares. He learned where to find the right kind of dirt and just how much water to mix with it so that they could be formed into strong bricks. And he enjoyed working alongside of his friends that he had known all of his life. It would be okay. That night, he told Mary, "You know, I've become a very capable builder. You should see the storage building in Ramses that our team has been working on. We've already completed the foundation, and we're ready to start placing the stones for the first level. You know, I think I made the right decision to work on Pharaoh's new supply cities." Verse 11. And they built for Pharaoh supply cities, Hithom and Ramses. As Joe and his friends started a new week on the job, the overseer called Joe's team of men together. He told them that he had a new message from Pharaoh. It was not going to be good news. "You men simply aren't working hard enough. The building is taking too long, and you're going to have to work some longer hours. Tomorrow, you will come here by the time the sun is rising. You will not leave until the sun has gone down and it is dark. You're going to have to come to work every day from now on. There will be no more time off for your Sabbath." Joe couldn't believe what he was hearing. "How could this be?" Joe protested to the overseer. "No," he said. "No, we're too far away from our families now. We're too long away from them. We have our homes to take care of, our livestock, and you certainly cannot expect us to work on the Sabbath." The overseer motioned to a nearby soldier who began to approach Joe. Before Joe knew what was happening, the soldier struck Joe in the stomach, knocking him down. "That," said the overseer, "is what happens to anyone who talks back or who questions what Pharaoh tells you to do. And just to teach you a lesson, none of you are going to receive any pay this week." And Joe was shocked. What's happening? How could they be treated this way by those men that they thought were their friends and neighbors? The Egyptians had always been kind to them. But now, it seemed like they were becoming slaves. The soldiers and overseers were taking a great deal of satisfaction in their new role as taskmasters. They had been given strict orders, direct from Pharaoh, to increase productivity by whatever means they felt was necessary. And so a few days later, Joe Israelite was told that your wife, Mary, she also has to come to work. She'll come with you the next day. Again, Joe boldly objected. "Sir, that's impossible. My wife's pregnant. She can't do any work like this." Once again, the overseer nodded to two soldiers standing nearby. Make an example of him," he said. And with that, the whip came out, and Joe was beaten with 5 stripes. Joe screamed in agony. "No! This can't be happening. What are you doing to me?" Can't you figure it out yet, you dirty Israelite? You're all our slaves now. All of you. You and your families now are working for Egypt. And you'll be doing whatever work we'll tell you to do for whatever food we might feel like giving you. No more wages. Don't worry. We'll see that you have enough to eat. We want you to be strong enough to work for us. We can't have weaklings building our great cities. That evening, Joe and his neighbors, who were on his work team, walked slowly and dejectedly back to their village. They were stunned and in disbelief over what was happening. How were they going to tell their wives and their older children what was happening? How could they have been so betrayed by people they thought were their friends? Now we're slaves? How could we have let this happen? How could God have let this happen? Perhaps God will deliver us soon. The men agreed. It was hopeless to try to revolt against the powerful Egyptian soldiers. They knew that if they tried, they'd be killed. There was nothing they could do. Joe wept as he told his wife Mary what had happened today, and he showed her his bloodied back. She too found it hard to believe, but still thought, maybe it won't be so bad. I have many Egyptian women friends. They'll still be good to us. And Joe, I'll be nearer to you during the day. I'll make sure you have enough food and water. And don't forget, Joe, we're going to have a child in just a few weeks. But things were never going to be the same for Joe and Mary Israelite. Life was going to get very hard. The days turned into weeks, into months and years. Joe tried praying to God for help, but it seemed so useless. And after a while, he just stopped. Verse 12. The more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew, and they were in dread of the children of Israel. Mary's first child came that spring, 1580 BCE. They had so many hopes for their new son, but now they knew he could only grow up in slavery to the Egyptians, just as his parents were, just as all the children had to learn. They couldn't be educated except in their home at night in secret. Joe and Mary tried to teach their son about God for a while. But little Benjamin had trouble believing in the God of his parents. Year after year went by. It was miserable, hard labor. How could these Egyptians think of so many projects for them to work on? Dig massive water canals here, and then build stone banks to hold back the mudslides along the Nile River. They had to build and repair walls around the cities to keep the invaders out. But the most challenging work of all, those horrible pyramids. Oh yes, some of the great pyramids had already stood for centuries. But there was always another one needed for a tomb of one of Egypt's officials. And those bricks. It seemed to Mary and her young son, Benjamin, that they had made a million of them all by themselves. So as the years passed, Joe and Mary had more children, all facing the same future. It was a bitter time. Nothing ever changed. After 40 years or so, the things of God were being forgotten, especially among the children. Most knew nothing of the Sabbath. The God of Israel, he must have died, or at least he's turned his back on them. Verse 13. So the Egyptians made the children of Israel serve with rigor, and they made their lives bitter with hard bondage in mortar and brick, and in all manner of service in the field. All their service in which they made them serve was with rigor. And so, Joe and Mary Israelite died as slaves in Egypt near about the same time. They were 72 years old. The year 1531 BCE. What they had envisioned as long, happy lives in Egypt together, surrounded by their family and friends, turned rather into a life of cruelty, hard labor, and hopelessness, just like it had for everyone they knew. As we move forward in time, Benjamin Israelite had been born in 1580 BCE, and he had children too, and they all grew up as slaves in Egypt. So we come on down to the year 1524 BCE. And I'll now introduce you to David Israelite, age 21. He's the son of Benjamin and the grandson of Arjo and Mary. David also was born, as they were all, into Egyptian slavery. David and his wife, Sarah, already have two children. It seems all the Israelite families had many children, and Sarah is pregnant with their third child. But again, nothing has changed for generations. Oh yes, David heard the elders talking about a deliverer to come, but he knew that's just folklore. It would be impossible to escape from Egypt. Why do they even talk about it? Day after day, back to work in the fields, making bricks, carving stones, lifting stones. The next year, 1523 BCE, Sarah is soon expecting their third child. Children have a way of bringing joy and happiness into an otherwise hopeless and discouraging situation. But at least David and Sarah had their children to enjoy. But now the Egyptians had something else in mind. It's now been 88 years since Joseph died. The Israelites have continued to flourish despite generations of forced slavery and oppression. The Egyptian officials are now becoming quite concerned that if the Israelite population keeps increasing, they will soon rise up in rebellion against them. They might even kill them. Oh, that can't happen. What to do? So Pharaoh, likely Thutmose I, he has a solution. Verse 15. Then the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, of whom the name of one was Shiprah, and the name of the other Puah. And he said, when you do the duties of a midwife for the Hebrew women, and you see them on the birth stools, if it is a son, you shall kill him. But if it's a daughter, then she shall live. Apparently, this is to happen in just one small region of Goshen where most of the Israelites lived. And it seems only these two midwives received these instructions to murder the male babies. Verse 17. But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the male children alive. David and Sarah heard the news of what was happening. They were so relieved to learn that the midwives were not going to carry out Pharaoh's orders. Their child would be fine. How could Pharaoh have thought of such a horrible thing? But there's something David and Sarah don't know. Pharaoh found out, and he was enraged. Verse 22. So Pharaoh commanded all of his people, saying, every son who is born you shall cast into the river. Every daughter you can save alive. If the midwives won't do it, then my soldiers will. And they're going to do it throughout all of the homes of the Israelites everywhere. panic begins to set in. There's no place to hide. In a few days, Sarah delivers her third child, a son, and they named him Shem, after Noah's son. And they desperately search for a way to hide him. But one day, as a soldier is passing by, little Shem begins to cry. "Shh, be quiet." The Egyptian soldier breaks down the door. David and Sarah beg the soldier to spare their son. "Oh no, please," they scream. "Please don't take our little baby." The soldier draws his sword, threatening David. "Get back! Get back or I'll take your other two children too." And with that, the soldier heads toward the banks of the river. David and Sarah are following, begging him. Maybe there's something they can do to save him. But on reaching the banks of the river, the soldier raises his arms, throws little Shem as hard as he can out into the deep water of the Nile. Sarah screams, "My baby! David, do something!" And the soldier draws his sword. "Go home," he demands. "There's nothing you can do." And little Shem disappears under the water and drowns in the Nile River, as so many of the other Israelite baby boys have done, some on the same day. And Sarah and David walk slowly back to their village, sobbing uncontrollable grief, and they wonder how their ancestors could ever have believed in a loving God. Meanwhile, Amram and Jochebed, who live somewhat closer to the Pharaoh's palace, also had a newborn boy. They had another son who was only 3 years old and an older daughter, age 11. "What are we going to do?" Jochebed asked her husband. "We can't let them kill our baby. You have to do something." So they had kept their baby hidden from the soldiers for 3 months. But they knew it was only a matter of time before he was going to be discovered. And then Amram, one of the few remaining men who remembered God and actually still trusted him, had been asking God to help him find a way to save his son. Soon an elaborate plan to at least save their baby's life came together. He began to explain it to Jochebed. "I have learned," he said, "that Pharaoh's daughter and her servants will come down to the river to bathe tomorrow. They'll be having one of their religious ceremonies then. I want you to prepare a basket. Smear it with tar so that it's waterproof. We're going to place our son into the basket and then let the current of the river float it down towards the princess." That plan seems so dangerous. "What if they know he's an Israelite baby and they'll drown him themselves?" But Jochebed was convinced, "Oh, no young woman could drown a helpless baby." And she was right. When the princess saw the unusual sight of a baby floating in a basket, she immediately felt compassion for the infant, and she showed him off to the other servant girls. All along, Amram and Jochebed's older daughter was watching along the riverbank what was going on. So she calls out to the princess, "Ma'am, I saw what happened. If this baby needs an Israelite nurse, I know where I can get one for you right away." "Well, of course," the princess said. "This little baby needs to be nursed and cared for now. I'll pay her well to take this baby and care for it for a little while for me." And so the little girl brought the princess and her baby brother home to her parents. The princess explained to Amram and Jochebed how she had found this child floating in the river and instructed Jochebed, "You nurse him, care for him until he's old enough to be brought back to the palace." Amram and Jochebed gave thanks to God for protecting their little baby and bringing him safely back home to them. But they knew it would not be long before they'd have to surrender him back to the princess. As the child grew, his parents worked diligently to teach him about God, even though most of the other children were taught nothing now about a God of Israel. And they knew they had only a very short time to try to instill the laws of God into the mind, the little young mind of this, their precious son. Now, we're not told the exact age of the child when he was taken back. To think about it, it seems it would have been perhaps up to 4, even 5 years old, since he realized later on that he was Hebrew, and he knew something about the God of the Hebrews. Well, regardless, the day came when Amram and Jochebed had to say goodbye to their little son. And the boy knew also the day would come. He was not afraid to go. He was very brave. But he was sad to leave the only parents he had ever known. Exodus 2, verse 10. And the child grew, and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. And so she called his name Moses, saying, "Because I drew you out of the water." Amram and Jochebed were overwhelmed with grief, but they gave thanks to God that now their little son, who was going to be called Moses, was alive, and he would actually become an important man in the palace of the Pharaoh. And thankfully, perhaps due to the influence of the princess, the slaughter of the newborn male children had soon stopped. About 35 more years were to pass, and nothing changes. The Israelites continue to build cities and monuments. Moses is raised and educated as an Egyptian prince, again, knowing little, if anything, about the Hebrew God. Moses receives the best military training, and he becomes a general, leading successful military campaigns against any invaders. And yet, he has a memory, a faint memory of his early childhood. He knew he looked different. He looked like the Israelite men, not like an Egyptian. In time, he became aware of just who he was, and how it was that he came to be a prince of Egypt. And he realized the Israelite people are a slave people, and they're serving me. And yet, I'm one of them. The personal conflict was agonizing. One day, Moses went to personally observe the conditions at one of the nearby construction sites. From his hiding place, he saw an Egyptian guard beating an exhausted Israelite man who could not continue his back-breaking work any longer. It was too much. And the man screamed for him to stop. But his pleas were ignored and the beatings continued until the man fell silent. In a rage of anger, Moses ran out from his hiding place, grabbed the club from the guard, swung it at him as hard as he could. And the blow landed on the side of his head, and the guard was killed instantly. Moses was shocked. "What have I done?" He looked around and was thankful that they were in a secluded area. There's nobody around. And Moses quickly dug a shallow grave in the sand and buried the man. After continuing to look all around, he was sure nobody had seen what happened. But he was wrong. He hadn't looked close enough. Verse 13. And when he went out on the second day, behold, two Hebrew men were fighting. And he said to the one who did the wrong, "Why are you striking your companion?" And then he said, "Who made you a prince and judge over us? You intend to kill me like you killed that Egyptian?" Moses was stunned. They know. They saw me. What was he going to do? So he turned around and he walked quickly away from them. He had no doubt that word of what he had done to the guard was quickly going to come to Pharaoh. So Moses realized there's only one thing he could do. But how? When? Well, he knew it had to be soon. So upon arriving back at the palace, Moses quickly puts together about 2 weeks' provision. And he finds his mother, the princess. He says, "I come to tell you goodbye." "Well, where are you going, Moses?" she asked. "Well, I just want to do some hunting and explore some of the wilderness lands for a few weeks. Don't worry, I'll be back before long." He could not tell her he was fleeing for his life. And so that night, Moses secretly walked away from the palace of Egypt, being careful to cover his tracks in the sand. As he made his journey, he looked eastward to a mountain range and decided he would try to find refuge there in the mountains of Midian. The next day, Pharaoh was informed by the soldiers that Moses was gone and what he had done. "Send for him. Find him. He shall be put to death for what he has done," Pharaoh said. But Moses was nowhere to be found. He had disappeared into the vast expanse of wilderness, and he was now approaching the land of Midian. In a few days, Moses stopped by a well to replenish his water supply. While there, 7 young women approached with a herd of animals for water. But suddenly, a few tough men appeared from over an embankment, likely intent not on just getting some water, but bothering the young women. But the men, had not seen Moses, who quickly intervened and ran them off. The women were grateful and helped Moses, and Moses helped them water their flocks. Before long, they went back home earlier than their father expected them. And their father, Reuel, was surprised that they were back so soon, and he asked, "Well, what's happened? Why are you back already?" And that, so they explained how an Egyptian man had helped them. Verse 20. So he said to his daughters, "Where is he? Why is it that you left the man? Call him that he may eat bread." Well, thankfully, Moses was not very far away, and he was easily found. So he accepted the invitation to come for dinner, and you know what happened next. For some reason, Moses decided to stay. This became his new home. And he took Reuel's daughter, her name Zipporah, as his wife. Before long, they had a son. His name was Gershom. And 40 more years would pass as Moses learned to be a humble shepherd in the land of Midian. Meanwhile, back in Egypt, the Israelites continued to work, to suffer, and to die in utter hopelessness. Verse 23. Now it happened in the process of time that the king of Egypt died. And then the children of Israel groaned because of the bondage, and they cried out. Notice it doesn't say where they cried out, who they cried out to. But their cry came up to God because of their bondage. God heard their groaning. And God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And God looked upon the children of Israel, and God acknowledged them. Moses is now 80 years old, the year 1443 BCE. Moses often thinks of his life back in Egypt, but he also thinks of the people known to him as the Hebrews. What must it be like for them? Are they still suffering? Is it worse? How could it be worse? So many of the people I knew back then, they're probably all dead. So a few days later, Moses is tending the sheep and is walking the fertile foothills toward the base of a mountain known as Mount Horeb. Suddenly, Moses is startled by a bright light. Was it the reflection of the sun? Was it the sun? Well, no, the sun's behind him. Looking up on the side of the mountain, he realizes that's a fire. It's a brush fire. Probably some careless shepherds who don't know how to put out their campfires. But as he hurried up the mountain to come closer to it, he realized this fire is contained to a very small spot. Just one large green leafy bush. And that was what was so amazing. He could actually see the green leaves. And they were not being burned by the fire. The fire that was so hot, he couldn't come any closer to it. This is incredible, he thought to himself. How can this be that this fire isn't destroying the bush? In the next moment, something even more amazing was to happen. Moses. He looked around behind him. Nobody there. I must be imagining things. A few seconds later, Moses, he heard it distinctly now. A voice is calling his name. It's coming from that bush. But that's impossible. In a flash, all the teaching he had grown up in Egypt about all the various gods filled his mind. Was this Ra, the fire god? That must be it. Or, wait, could this possibly be the god of his ancestors, the god of the Hebrews? There's so much about that god he didn't know. He was about to find out. Moses began to speak nervously back to the voice coming from the bush. Here I am. Verse 5. Exodus 3. God said, "Do not come near this place. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place where you stand is holy ground. I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." And Moses trembled in fear, attempting to hide his face from the presence of this great God. "The God of my father? You mean Amram? I barely remember anything about him. But I know some of the Hebrews worshipped an unseen God." Verse 7, the voice continued, "I have surely seen the oppression of my people who are in Egypt, and I have heard their cry because of their taskmasters, and I know their sorrow. And so I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians, and I will bring them up from that land to a good and a large land, to a land flowing with milk and honey. Now therefore, behold, the cry of the children of Israel has come to me, and I have seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppress them. So come now, therefore, I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt." And Moses was shocked. "Who am I to be sent to Pharaoh? They'll know who I am. They'll try to kill me." God said, "I'll be with you. And you will know that, because one day you're going to bring the Israelites out of Egypt to this very mountain." Moses was still not sure. "But who are you? What shall I tell the people when they ask me who has sent me to deliver them?" And God said to Moses, I am who I am. Thus you shall say to the children of Israel, I am has sent me to you. And Moses could not believe what was happening. This is far too great a task for me. I'm not worthy. I'm not capable of doing what this powerful God is asking me to do. Chapter 4, verse 1. And Moses said, suppose they'll not believe me or listen to my voice. Suppose they say, the Lord has not appeared to you. And so the Lord said to him, what is that in your hand? A rod. Cast it to the ground. So he cast it on the ground, and it became a serpent. And Moses fled from it. Reach out your hand, take it by the tail. Really? So he reached out his hand, he caught it, and it became a rod in his hand. That you may believe that the Lord God has appeared to you. Now, put your hand in your bosom. And he put his hand in his bosom. And when he took it out, behold, it's leprosy, white as snow. Moses, put your hand in your bosom again. So he put his hand in his bosom again, and he drew it out of his bosom, and behold, it was restored like his other flesh. And it shall be, God said, if they do not believe even these two signs or listen to your voice, that you shall take water from the river and pour it out on dry land, and the water that you take from the river will become blood on the dry land. Amazingly, Moses is still not ready to accept this. Oh, my Lord, Moses said to the Lord, I am not eloquent, neither before or even since you've spoken to your servant. I'm slow of speech and slow of tongue. Moses, I made your mouth. I'll be with your mouth. I will tell you what to say. Moses is still not convinced. And he said, oh, my Lord, please, please send by the hand of someone else that you may send. That was not a good answer. Verse 14, the anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses. And we know the rest of the story. God goes on to agree to send his brother Aaron with him, and he will meet up with him later. It may be speculation that at this time God revealed many more things to Moses that's not recorded for us here. Could this be the time Moses learned more about the true God, learned about all the events that are recorded for us in the book of Genesis up to the time of Joseph? Again, it's not revealed, but Moses at some time had to learn the details of his history and the history of his people. But for now, Moses is finally convinced this is really the Creator God who is worthy of his respect, his faith, and his obedience. Verse 18. So Moses went and returned to Jethro, his father-in-law, also known as Reuel. Jethro is more of a priestly title. Please let me go and return to my brethren who are in Egypt and see whether or not they're still alive. And Jethro said, go in peace. Notice he apparently does not tell Jethro yet about receiving this miraculous message from God that he's going to deliver Israel. But Moses does explain all that has happened to his wife Zipporah and his two sons. And so after a few days, they set off for the long journey to Egypt. After a couple of days of traveling, they arrive at a place to camp on the east side of the Red Sea. But rather than relaxing for the evening, Moses is about to be attacked. It is from someone very unexpected. Verse 24. And it came to pass on the way at the encampment that the Lord met Moses and sought to kill him. At first, Moses has no clue who his attacker was. "Who are you?" he screamed. "What do you want? Why are you trying to kill me?" Just then the attacker pulled Moses' arms back behind him and whispered into his ear, "I am," the man said. And in an instant, Moses realized who this was. The man who was attacking him was the same being who had spoken to him from the burning bush. Now, we're actually told very little about this encounter, but we know what happens next. Zipporah takes a sharpened rock and performs circumcision on her son, most likely Gershom. Why? What's going on that the Lord God would threaten Moses with death over the fact that his son was not circumcised? We know part of God's covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob was the acknowledgement of that covenant, that special covenant, through the physical act of circumcision. Whoever was not circumcised among the males of God's people would be cut off or destroyed from among them. Now, the Midianites were also descendants of Abraham, but through his wife Keturah and through their son Midian. But the Midianites, while they practiced circumcision, they did it in a different way. They practiced circumcision on a groom right before his marriage, instead of circumcising male infants. So it is apparent that God was holding Moses responsible for circumcising his son, but Moses had neglected it, assuming, well, it will be done when Gershom's ready to marry. But God wants it done now. And surprisingly, Moses demands that Zipporah does the act. And she objects. And she throws it down at his feet and says, "You are a bloody man to me." But in any event, Moses was not following God's instructions. This was significant because it involved the very sign of the covenant people, and it was being violated by the one who was to become their national leader. Moses' disobedience, even though he may not have realized he was disobeying, in the light of these factors, it made it a capital offense. He was worthy of death. If he failed to do this, he would have to die. But once the circumcision was completed, the Lord released Moses and allowed him to continue on his journey. But no, Zipporah was very angry and bewildered by what was going on. She wanted to go back to Midian and take her sons with her. And Moses is heartsick at the thought of being separated from his family for who knows how long. But he also knew the difficulties that were ahead of him, and so he consented for them to return to Midian. Meanwhile, back in Egypt, Aaron, the older brother of Moses, received a shocking message from God. "Your brother Moses lives. You must leave Egypt and go meet him. You are to travel beyond the Red Sea, down through the wilderness to Mount Horeb. Moses will be there waiting for you." Aaron couldn't believe that his long-lost brother was still alive. Everyone had thought he had died in the desert. And so the next day, Aaron set out on his long journey toward the mountains of the southeast. After sending Zipporah and his sons back to Midian, Moses waited nearby for a few days to make sure Zipporah had arrived home safely, and also to spend some time reflecting on the great mission that God had given him that he was about to undertake. Finally, he packed up and headed on toward the mountain where he had seen the burning bush just a few weeks earlier. He remembered that God had told him that his brother Aaron was coming. Perhaps this is where they would meet. So a few days later, as Moses approached the base of the mountain, he again noticed smoke from a campfire. But sure enough, it was his brother. Verse 27. And so he went and met him on the mountain of God and kissed him. And Moses told Aaron all the words of the Lord who had sent him and all the signs which he had commanded him. It was a joyous reunion. They had so much to talk about. But as we know, this was only the beginning. So it's an incredible story, especially when you try to place yourself into the story as it was happening. And that's what we've tried to do today. But why? What have we learned by rehearsing this story of the early days of Moses, as if we were there? Today, we serve the very same God who was so much involved with Moses. He is the God of the impossible. He is a God of miracles and of divine intervention. Our God knows how to design a plan and execute it perfectly according to His purpose. While it seemed to the Israelites that their God had long ago abandoned them, He was right there all along. He heard their cries. He saw their suffering. He knew it when little baby Shem was thrown into the river. He saw the weakened Israelite clubbed to death by the Egyptian guard. He heard their screams when they were lashed with the whips. God knew why His people were there. He knew the horrors. He knew about the evil that was taking place in Egypt. But that was His plan. And now His plan is beginning to unfold and become clear to others. Over and over again, God tells us never to abandon Him. To always trust Him, even when it doesn't seem like we should. No matter what the physical circumstances may be, we're told to always trust Him. He knows what He's doing, even when there's no possible way we can understand it. God has promised to deliver us from sin and from death and bring us into a promised land. And God's been working with us all along, even when we had no idea that He was there. He was there watching us. He was there waiting for the right time to come to rescue us. And so He has. And that's what it was like for Joe Israelite and his descendant David and all of the children of Israel. And that's what it was like for Moses. In the next sermon, we'll continue the story, beginning with the first encounter with Pharaoh, and take it forward to the triumphant march out of Egypt.